Thank you for listening to this message from Northwest Hills Community Church in Corvallis, Oregon. You can learn more about our church at nwhills.com. Today, lead pastor Josh Carstensen continues a series called What is Going On, where we read the entire Bible in a year. In Exodus, God saves his people, the Israelites, after 400 years of slavery. During it, God executed fierce judgment towards the Egyptians with 10 purposeful plagues and radical mercy to his people. God's patient mercy continues throughout the book, even as his people continue to rebel. And near the end, there's a sweet, merciful moment when God clearly describes himself to Moses. After the message, read the book of Exodus. Also, check out nwhills.com/hub for additional resources like book overviews, reading plans, and application questions. Now, here's today's message.
If you got a Bible, we're going to the second book, the book of Exodus. Last week, we started a year-long journey through the entire Bible. And the invitation really for everyone is that if you're a follower of Jesus, and if you're exploring, and if you're trying to figure out who God is, the invitation to join us is reading it on your own. And we recognize that's a beast of a challenge. We recognize that Sunday mornings are a great launch point, but we don't want this to be the only place where you hear God's word. And so we're going to challenge you every single week. Read God's word, and we have a book, a little kind of journal resource to help you with that. We ran out last week, but we got a bunch more this week. So if you did not get one, we would just encourage you, go grab one and just join with us. Every Sunday is going to be kind of a launch for the week. So last week we started in Genesis, and then the invitation is to read throughout the week. So, you know, I talked to a few people who finished reading this morning, and, you know, got ready for the test today, but now we're in Exodus, okay? So you can read Exodus this next week. As we started Genesis last week, we started with the observation that from the beginning of the book to the end of the book, there's a lot of questions and a huge change. Right from the very beginning, the opening lines, it is this beautiful, God is created, everything's good, it's in a garden, there's no sin and there's no death. And then by the time you get to the end of chapter 50, you've got Joseph who's dead in Egypt. And it leaves you with a lot of questions. God, what in the world just happened? I mean, first of all, we have a massive amount of time that passed by, but not just the time that passed by, but from no death creation to I'm dead in a pagan land where no one's worshiping you. God, what are you doing? And we said that by the end, we are going to see that God knows exactly what he's doing. And we kind of teed it up for this week where we're going to see, man, there is a God who is all-powerful, all-knowing, and he knows from the beginning to the end, he has a plan, and he's working and he's moving it. And today we're going to see that plan. We're going to see who this God is. And so in the book of Exodus, we're going to see this God who really shows the entire nation of Egypt who he is, the world's superpower at the time. This is who I am. You guys are worshiping gods, and I'm the one true God. I want you to know me. By the end, we're going to see some very clear, very direct statements about who God is, statements that we haven't seen anywhere else in the Bible so far. God's just going to say, this is me. And we don't get a lot of those. We get, you know, pictures as God is moving and working. But in Exodus, we see God himself say, no, this is who I am. And so we're going to see that today. And really, by the end of today, my hope is that, man, we see God's goodness, that we see God's mercy, that we see his kindness, that by the end of it all, my hope is that we have a response like Moses. When God says to him, and we're going to read this, God says to him, hey, you can have everything. I'm going to give you the land, I'm going to give you the people, I'm going to give you success, but I'm not going with you. And Moses says, God, unless you go with me, I don't want anything. How do we get there? Because most of our world says, I'll take everything else. Jesus, I don't really need you. Right? Most of our world says, I'd love the influence, I'd love the power, I'd love the career, I'd love the family, I'd love the spouse, I'd love all the things, and God, if you want to join me in that, that would be nice, but I don't necessarily need you. How do we get to the point where we say, without you, I don't want anything? And so with Moses, we're going to see that today. I don't want anything without you. How does he get to that spot? To answer that, we're going to pick it right back up in Exodus chapter 1. We're going to pick up in the coffin. There's death. And so if you can, would you stand with me? Exodus 1, starting in verse 6. And we're going to work through it. Yeah, I do need more time. Starting in verse 6. Then Joseph died, and all his brothers and all that generation. But the people of Israel were fruitful and increased greatly. They multiplied and grew exceedingly strong, so that the land was filled with them. Verse 8, now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph, and he said to his people, behold, the people of Israel are too many and too mighty for us. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply. And if war breaks out, they join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land. Therefore, they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with heavy burdens. They built for Pharaoh store cities, Pithom and Ramesses. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied, and the more they spread abroad. And the Egyptians were in dread of the people of Israel. So they ruthlessly made the people of Israel work as slaves and made their lives bitter with hard service in mortar and brick and in all kinds of work in the fields. In all their work, they ruthlessly made them work as slaves. This is the painful word of the Lord. You can grab a seat. Man, we see a progression in history, and we've talked about this before, of how this becomes normative. We see that when you have groups of people who are different from one another, you've got a different religion, you've got a different race, you've got a different language, it's really easy to separate from one another, right? When you separate from one another, when you have different beliefs, ultimately you form two different camps where you're saying, we're good, they're bad, right? We're right, they're wrong. And ultimately, it leads to a terrible slide of, I'm going to oppress you. And we see this throughout history. We see it in families. We see it across nations. We see it politically. And so we see this very clearly, this fear of the unknown, of these people who are different. Therefore, we should use them and abuse them and get what we want from them. And the hope in the prayer would be for us, man, if there are people who are different than us, if there is someone who is different than you, man, we want to get to know them. We want to love them. We want to see them as people. So this does not happen. But here we see this terrible, terrible 400 years of slavery, and it's awful, right? It gets so bad that as we read the story of Exodus, after 400 years, you see this Pharaoh who's saying, hey, now we actually have to kill their children as well. I mean, just put yourself in here. You're a Hebrew, you're having a boy, and they're literally throwing the boys into the Nile. I mean, the level of abuse, the level of pain, it's hard to kind of wrap our minds around, which leaves us with a lot of these what's going on questions. What is going on, God? Where are you in all this? And then if you were paying attention last week and you read in Genesis 15, I think it's in Genesis 15, 13, that God actually made a promise to Abraham when he called him and he said, oh, by the way, like this is going to happen in a few generations. God, what is that about? God, where are you when you're allowing 400 years of slavery and you're allowing the murder of children thrown into the Nile? God, what is going on here? Why would God allow this type of suffering to happen? Right? 400 years. Is it just because the people didn't cry out? Right? You think for 400 years no one said, God, would you do something about this? And he's all, finally, 400 years, someone asked me. I doubt it. Right? Like, why 400 years? We went through this study in Exodus a couple of years ago here. We studied it for about 6 months. And one of the things that we saw and we're going to see today is that 400 years really sets us up to say that there's no way that they're getting out unless God does something. It sets up a massive problem. It sets up the problem of there is no possible feasible explanation that they are getting out unless God does something here. And God does something in a mighty, magnificent way. Right? So we're going to see a correlation between the bigger the problem, the better the rescue. Right? The more desperate they are, the more helpless they are, the more God is going to show his power. Right? Which is like, okay, great. Like, God, you're showing your power in a mighty way. But what about like all the people who are suffering? Right? It's one thing to get up here and say, man, for 400 years, God let it get really, really bad so he would look really, really good. Right? What if you're in year like 230 and your daughter's being abused and your son's working in the, you know, the hay and the brick? And what if you're year 400 and your son got ripped out and thrown into the Nile? Like, does that seem worth it? God, for you to be great? What's going on there? We got to go back to Genesis 3, and we got to see the problem of all this is sin is real, right? Evil is real. We were introduced this in early Genesis, that there is a brokenness in the heart of mankind that abuses and takes advantage of and hurts one another. And ultimately, God's going to do something about that today. And what we're going to see today is God is a God of fierce judgment. And he executes this fierce judgment on this nation of Egypt. But we're also going to see a God who is radically merciful. And we talked about kind of God's judgment and his grace last week. And today it culminates in this really fantastic, epic, beautiful story of God rescuing a people. But we're going to focus today on his fierce judgment and his radical mercy. And this is a tension that we're going to get throughout the entire Bible. This is probably, I think, the biggest question that you will ever wrestle with as a Christian. Why is it that sometimes it feels like God brings judgment, and why is it sometimes that God brings mercy? Right? I have this question a lot. I have this question about friends of mine who don't know the Lord. I have this question about people who are doing well. I have this question about people who are suffering. God, why do you bring mercy on some and judgment on others? What is that about? Right? And this is something that we wrestle with all the time. Even just last week, I was having lunch on Friday with Pastor Rob from Calvary. And I was asking him, like, hey, tell me some of your secret sauce. You've been at this 27 years. You know, how have you done what you've been able to do? And the first words out of my mouth, he says, mercy. He says, God's been gracious. So why is it that we can see God's mercy and grace so evident in some people's life, but we see judgment in other places? Man, this is a tension that we're going to live in until we die. In this book, we're going to see so clearly God's judgment and his mercy. So let's start with his fierce judgment. Let's go Exodus chapter 2, verse 23. The people cry out to God, God, would you do something? Right? Verse 23, during these many days, the king of Egypt died, and the people of Israel groaned because of their slavery and cried out for help. Their cry for rescue from slavery came up to God, and God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. God saw the people of Israel, and God knew. Right, that language there is ultimately saying, God saying, okay, now is the time I'm going to do something about this. And as he does something about this, he calls this 80-year-old man, kind of from obscurity in some ways. This is Moses. We're going to get to know him today and over the next few weeks as we're looking at the books that he wrote. But here's someone who is an ex-murderer. He's kind of on the run. He's kind of living in hiding in a lot of ways, kind of just hoping to live out his life. And God says, I'm going to use you to free my people. You are going to be my voice piece, my mouthpiece, and through you, I'm going to do something great. And then we get to these 10 plagues, these 10 famous plagues. And it's kind of interesting. You think about these plagues and it seems fantastical. And as a kid, you're like, this is so cool. And as an adult, you're like, this seems so weird, right? Like it seems so fairy tale-ish. Like, again, we're a modern people. Like you go through the plagues and you're like, okay, you turn the river into blood. That seems weird and silly. And you bring a bunch of frogs and that seems fun for a little bit, but weird. And gnats and flies and, you know, you got boils and hail and locusts and darkness and death. And again, it can kind of cause you to ask questions like, is this real or is this like a kid's story? Like, why would God do this? This seems really silly. Why not just free your people? What's going on here? Well, first of all, if God wanted to do it that way, he could have. He's God. He can do whatever he wants. And there's a lot of things in the Bible that seem silly. But as we read the story of Exodus and as we understand the kind of landscape of what was happening here in the worship of pagan gods, we're going to see God was very intentional in how he brought these plagues. God is saying something through this story, and he's really asserting his power over the worship of gods in Israel. Because think with me for a minute, why these plagues? right? What was going on in the worship of all these Egyptian deities? We talked about last week. This is a superpower in the world. Right, we're talking, this is when the pyramids were built. This is the height of the ancient Egypt world. And they had a huge amount of gods, and they worshiped them. And behind these gods were real, actual gods. Right, we're talking, there's real power here. Right, think about when Moses throws his stick down and it becomes a snake, and Pharaoh's like, oh yeah, that's a cute trick. We can do that too. Like, there's real power there. There's real power behind the gods that they're worshiping. And through these different plagues, we're going to see God saying, I'm going to assert my ultimate power over your little power. We see throughout the plagues where God is speaking through Moses to Pharaoh and to the people, these different phrases where God's going to say, ultimately, I'm going to show you that I am the Lord, and I'm going to do this through these plagues. We see this in chapter 7, verse 5. Hello. Speaking of plagues, this has never happened to me. There's a bug that just flew on me. That's creepy. Gosh, that's weird. God can do whatever he wants. I'm literally about to read. All right. Chapter 7, verse 5, the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord when I stretch out my hand against Egypt and bring out the people of Israel from among them. Chapter 9, verse 13, let my people go that they may serve me. For this time I will send all my plagues on you yourself. For a while it didn't happen to Pharaoh and his people. It's like, now I'm going to send it to you on your servants and your people, so that you may know that there is none like me in all the earth, right? For by now I could have put out my hand and struck you and your people with pestilence, and you would have been cut off from the earth. Here's God saying, I could have just eliminated you. You could have just not woken up. I could have done that, and I could have established my reign with these people right here, and they could have had all your storehouses and all, you know, your pyramids and all your power. But for this purpose, I have raised you up, verse 16, to show you my power so that my name might be proclaimed in all the earth. Right? Chapter 12, verse 12, and on all the gods of Egypt, I will execute my judgment. I am the Lord. And if you're to walk down all the different plagues and how God, through Moses, is bringing about all the pestilence and the hurt and the pain, it's an assault on every single one of these pagan gods, right? You start with the Nile, right? The Nile is their source of protection. It's their source of food and supply. And God says, all right, I'm going to turn that to blood, right? You go down to the blotting out of the sun. They worship the sun. And God's like, oh yeah, I got power over that. To the ultimate, the final plague of the death of the firstborn. Right, Pharaoh is supposed to be the most powerful of all gods. He's supposed to be the actual son of Ra himself, and he was supposed to bring protection and provision to all the people. And God's going to say, oh, Pharaoh, you think you can provide? You think you can protect your people? You think you're this great and mighty nation? Let me wipe out the firstborn of everyone, including all animals, and see how the people will not worship you. God is executing his judgment. All the way to the final scene where he has executed his judgments against all these gods, and everyone's like, okay, like, you clearly have more power than us. And Pharaoh's like, okay, fine, you can leave. And as they leave, as this massive nation of a few million people are leaving, Pharaoh changes his mind. He's like, you know what? Maybe there's one last chance. Maybe we can kind of recapture them and bring them back. Follow me. We're going to read a big section of this final scene in chapter 14. Starting in verse 4, this is God speaking. He says, and I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and he will pursue them. Meaning he's going to pursue the people who are fleeing. God says, and I will get glory over Pharaoh and all his hosts, and all the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord. All right, so why is God doing this? He's doing this again and again to show the people, I am God. Verse 6, so Pharaoh made ready his chariot, and he took his army with him. And he took 600 chosen chariots and all the other chariots of Egypt with officers over all of them. And the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and he pursued the people of Israel while the people of Israel were going out defiantly. The Egyptians pursued them, all Pharaoh's horses and chariots and his horsemen and his army. When Pharaoh drew near, the people of Israel lifted up their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians were marching after them, and they feared greatly, and the people of Israel cried out to the Lord. Verse 13, and Moses said to the people, "Fear not, stand firm and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will work for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you shall never see again. For the Lord will fight for you, and you have only to be silent." Go verse 21. Then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord drove the sea back by a strong east wind all night and made the sea dry land, and the waters were divided. And the people of Israel went into the midst of the sea on dry ground, and the waters being a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. The Egyptians pursued them and went in after them into the midst of the sea, all Pharaoh's horses, his chariots, his horsemen. And in the morning, watch, the Lord, in the pillar of fire and the cloud, looked down on the Egyptian forces and threw the Egyptian forces into a panic, clogging their chariot wheels so that they drove heavily. And the Egyptians said, "Let us flee from before Israel, for the Lord fights for them against the Egyptians." Then the Lord said to Moses, "Stretch out your hand over the sea, that the water may come back upon the Egyptians, upon their chariots, upon their horsemen." So Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the sea returned to its normal course when the morning appeared. And as the Egyptians fled into it, the Lord threw the Egyptians into the midst of the sea. The waters returned and covered the chariots and horsemen and all of the host of Pharaoh that had followed them into the sea. Not one of them remained. And you think about the mightiest nation potentially on the planet. And you think about through one obscure, tiny little family from the middle of nowhere, and God saying, "I'm going to execute my judgment, and I want the world to know who I am." You think about the worship of Pharaoh, you think about the worship of all these gods, and God saying, "They have nothing on me. They have nothing. And not only am I going to show you my power, I'm going to literally destroy your entire army." We see God makes a promise. "I will execute my judgment on things that are wrong." Right, so when we look around and we hear stories of whether it's abuse or enslavement, right, when you're wondering what is going on, why are these things happening, the promise from very early on is, "Oh, I'm going to do something about sin. I'm going to do something about what's wrong. And not only am I going to do something about sin, and am I going to do something about what's wrong, but I'm going to do something about worship of anything that is not me," which is a little bit scary because how easy is it for us to worship things that are not God? Right? How easy is it for us to say, "Man, I'm going to follow this, and this is going to be my God," whether it's the weekend, right? Whether it's my career, whether it's my family, whether it's entertainment, whether it's sports, whether it's a drive for influence or power or looks or whatever you throw into your category of what you want God to be. God says, "I'm going to execute my judgment on all of it." So what are we worshiping? Right? This story of Exodus should be a strong reminder that ultimately God will bring judgment. But we also see a God who is radically merciful. Right? You go back to chapter 14, verse 13, and listen to what he says. He says, "Fear not, stand firm, and see the salvation of the Lord." See what I'm going to do. He says this to this nation of Israel who's running. They have no ability to fight back here. Right? It's not like God says, "Okay, I'm going to arm you, and you're going to do whatever you can. You're going to fight through the night, and you're going to take on the army." God says, "You run away, I'm going to do the fighting for you. I'm going to do this in this mighty, incredible, beautiful way." And we jump in verse 29. "But the people of Israel walked on dry ground through the sea, the waters being a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. Thus the Lord saved Israel that day from the hand of the Egyptians, and Israel saw the Egyptians dead on the seashore. Israel saw the great power that the Lord had used against the Egyptians, so the people feared the Lord, and they believed in the Lord and in his servant Moses." Man, that is radical mercy. They didn't do anything. They didn't deserve it. God's just like, "I'm going to be kind to you, and I'm going to fight for you because you have an enemy that you cannot conquer." As the story continues, we're going to see, yes, that they had an enemy in Egypt that they couldn't conquer, but in the whole second half of the book, we're going to see that they had an even greater enemy, an enemy that wasn't external, but an enemy that was internal. And we're going to see a God who has mercy not only on the external enemy, but on the internal enemy. right? As they cross the Red Sea, they get to the other side, and, you know, God has done something incredible. He's freed them, yes. And what happens? Immediately after they get on the other side of the Red Sea, it's a couple of days, and all of a sudden they're hungry. And what do they say? They say, God, you're not good. You can't provide for us. God, you may have been able to get us to the other side of the Red Sea, but life was better back in Egypt. Can we just go back there? And God's going, are you kidding me? God, I just freed these people. But what does he do? In mercy, he provides food. He literally rains down bread from heaven, right? That's chapter 16. Chapter 17, the next chapter, right? After God literally says, well, you're hungry, I will feed you. Right? The very next chapter, chapter 17, they do the same thing. They're thirsty. They haven't had water for a few days. Listen to what it says in chapter 17, verse 2. Therefore, the people quarreled with Moses and said, give us water to drink. And Moses said to them, why do you quarrel with me? Why do you test the Lord? But the people thirsted there for water, and the people grumbled against Moses and said, why did you bring us up out of Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst? What does God do? He's merciful again. He provides water again. And then God does something incredible. From chapters 19 through 40, we have a one-year period of time where he brings them to the bottom of Mount Sinai and he says, guys, you are going to be my people. I'm going to be your God. Through you, I will literally be you will be a representative of me to the world. He says, you will be a kingdom of priests, right? A possession of mine. You will be a holy nation. And he says, hey, would you just follow me? Would you just obey me? Would you just commit to me? And what do the people say? All that you say, Lord, we will do. Like, we are so in, God, we are going to be your people. So he says, awesome, Moses, come on up to the mountain. I'm going to give you my instructions on how to live. And we get the Ten Commandments. And listen, this is so clear. God says, this is the first thing. I brought you out of Egypt. Listen, chapter 20, verse 2. I am the Lord your God. I brought you up out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. In other words, you didn't do anything. I did everything. I freed you. You shall have no other gods before me. That's the first thing that he says. Right? Remember Egypt? Remember they worshiped all these gods that weren't the one true God? Don't have any gods before me. You shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above or that is in the earth beneath or that is in the waters under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquities of the fathers on the children to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing steadfast love to thousands of those who love me and keep my commandments. And he goes on and he gives the rest of the Ten Commandments, right? Honor your father and your mother, right? Obey the Sabbath. Don't lie. Don't steal. Don't commit murder. For 40 days, he's with God and he comes back down and the people are like, yes! Like literally, they again and again, all the words the Lord has spoken, we will do and we will be obedient. This is like back and forth ceremony. People are going to follow. They're going to obey. And God says, Moses, come back up the mountain. I'm going to give you my instructions on what worship ought to look like and what a tabernacle and what a dwelling place for me will look like. And so Moses goes back up the mountain for another 40 days. And what happens when he's gone 40 days? The one thing God says, I don't want you to do. Right? They build this ridiculous golden calf. Right, verse 30, chapter 32, just follow me. 32, verse 1, when the people saw that Moses delayed to come up from the mountain, the people gathered themselves together to Aaron and said to him, up, make us gods who shall go before us. As for this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him. So Aaron, this is Moses' brother, said to them, take off the rings of gold that are in your ears of your wives, your sons, and your daughters, and bring them to me. So all the people took off the rings of gold that were in their ears and brought them to Aaron. And he received the gold from their hand and fashioned it with a graving tool and made a golden calf. And they said, these are your gods of Israel who brought you up out of the land of Egypt. This has to be one of the darkest, most confusing passages in all of Scripture. And also one of the most telling of the human condition. Right? This condition where it's like, God's just like, I'm providing for you. I got you. Right? Like, I'll take care of you. Right? When we're asking, what is going on, God? And God's saying, hey, I will literally take care of you. I've got you. And then we perpetually turn our back and say, I'm going to worship all these other things. I'm going to literally chase anything but the one thing that you said not to do. God said, don't worship any other gods. Don't make a carved image. Moses is gone for 40 days, and what does the nation do? They create this false god. And here's the moment where God says, all right, I'm done. He says, I'm out. He says, I will do what I promised Abraham. He says, I'm going to give you the land that I promised Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph. I will send an angel before you. I will drive out the Canaanites, the Amorites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. Go up to a land flowing with milk and honey. I'm going to give you everything that you think you want, but I'm not going with you. I'm not going with you. Like, you can have it all. You can have the influence. You can have the power. You can have the leisure. You can have the retirement. You can get the job. You can get the wife, whatever. But I'm not going with you. And we feel this tension between God's judgment and his mercy. And Moses begs him. He goes, no, God, if you're not going, we're not going. And why is he able to do that? Why is Moses able to say that? He's able to say that ultimately because he goes, I've seen your power. God, I knew we had nothing without you. We were enslaved. I saw you tear apart the Red Sea. I saw the entire Egyptian army defeated. God, without you, it may feel good for a little while, but it's nothing. God, without you, it's nothing. God, we can't go. I've seen what life is like without you. God, would you be merciful to us? We keep forgetting. And ultimately, God says, okay, I'll be merciful. I'll go with you. And I love Moses. He's so human here. He's like, I believe you, God, but can you just show me? Can you show me a sign that you're going to go with us? And we get this beautiful picture, and I think this picture is so reminiscent of the cross. He gives us this picture where God says to Moses, like, hey, I'm going to give you a picture of me, but you can't handle the whole thing. So I'm going to throw you into the cleft of a rock, and I'm going to pass by. I'm going to cover your face, and I'm going to go by. And you're going to know who I am. And you're going to remember that I'm a God both of mercy and of judgment. And I think we get the same picture in this cross. Right, so every time that we come in and we see this cross here on Sunday, we get this reminder of God's incredible mercy to us and his judgment. Because on that cross, we get both mercy and judgment. And God says to Moses, here's who I am. This is the God that I am. I will go with you because I am a God of mercy. And we get the clearest definition in all of the early Bible of who God is in chapter 34, verse 5. Band, why don't you come up here? I'm going to read a whole lot here in a bit. So band, come on up. Chapter 34, verse 5. This is God speaking to Moses. The Lord descended in the cloud and stood there with him and proclaimed the name of the Lord. This is God speaking. The Lord, a God merciful and gracious, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness, keeping steadfast love for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin, but who will by no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children and the children's children to the third and fourth generation. And Moses quickly bowed his head towards the earth and worshiped. This description that God gives to Moses, he gives again and again and again throughout the whole story that we're going to read here this next year. And I want you to hear, I'm going to pray, and I want you to hear all these different places where God speaks in the same way. Lord, I thank you for the story of Exodus. It's a hard and yet beautiful story of our need for rescue, of our need for salvation from sin that is external and sin that is internal, because we have a propensity in all of our hearts to ultimately make gods out of things that we ought not to chase what ultimately is not satisfying, because anything short of you is not what is right. And God, you are merciful to Moses. You are merciful to us. Lord, that cross is the culmination of you taking on judgment and you pouring out mercy. And we're going to see this again and again in your scripture, people thanking you for your mercy. Psalm 86, verse 15, but you, O Lord, are a God merciful and gracious, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness. Joel 2:13, and rend your hearts and not your garments. Return to the Lord your God, for he is gracious and merciful, slow to anger, abounding in steadfast love, and he relents over disaster. Psalm 103, verse 8, the Lord is merciful and gracious. He's slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love. He will not always chide, nor will he keep his anger forever. He does not deal with us according to our sins, nor repay us according to our iniquities. For as high as the heavens are above the earth, so great is his steadfast love towards those who fear him. As far as the east is from the west, as far does he remove our transgressions from us. As a father shows compassion to his children, so the Lord shows compassion to those who fear him. Psalm 145, verse 8. The Lord is gracious and merciful, slow to anger, abounding in steadfast love. Nehemiah 9:17, they refused to obey and were not mindful of the wonders that you performed among them, but they stiffed their necks and appointed a leader to return to their slavery in Egypt. But you are a God ready to forgive. You are gracious, you are merciful, you are slow to anger, abounding in steadfast love, and you did not forsake them. Jonah chapter 4, verse 2, and he prayed to the Lord and said, O Lord, is not this what I said when I was yet in my country? That is why I made haste to flee to Tarshish, for I knew that you are a gracious God and merciful. You are slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love and relenting from disaster. Numbers 14, verse 17, and now please let the power of the Lord be great as you have promised, saying the Lord is slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love, forgiving iniquities and transgressions. He will by no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquities of the fathers to the children to the third and fourth generation. Please pardon the iniquity of this people according to the greatness of your steadfast love, just as you have forgiven this people from Egypt until now. Micah 7:18. Who is a God like you, pardoning iniquity and passing over transgression for the remnant of his inheritance? He does not retain his anger forever because he delights in steadfast love.
Thanks for listening to today's teaching from Northwest Hills Community Church. We hope you find ways to apply the gospel to your life. And be sure to check out our website, nwhills.com, where you'll find ways to engage with us. And if you're able, we'd love to see you at church next Sunday. Thanks again for listening.